six case, Brumfield versus Sea Gov, United States. Mr. Kelly.
May it please the court, my name is Chris Kelly. I represent David Brumfield in this appeal from the sentence that was imposed upon him by the district court. Mr. Brumfield pled guilty to distributing 2 grams of cocaine. He was sentenced on the basis of about 2.5 kilograms of cocaine, an amount that is more than 1,000 times the amount that was involved in his offense of conviction. It's our contention on appeal that the district court's finding as to the relevant conduct in which Mr. Brumfield was involved was not based on reliable evidence, and we're therefore asking this court to vacate Mr. Brumfield's sentence. In the short amount of time that I have this morning, I'd like to focus on 2 points. The first is the lack of evidence that any drugs that were possessed or sold by other people in the Carol Armstrong crime family were either foreseeable by Mr. Armstrong or were part of a jointly undertaken criminal activity. And the second point is the lack of any reliable evidence that Mr. Brumfield sold 1.3 kilograms himself, as the district court found. Turning to the foreseeability issue, the court held Brumfield responsible for about 1.25 kilograms of cocaine that were distributed by other people. Brumfield could only be held responsible for those drugs if those sales were both in furtherance of a jointly undertaken criminal activity and were foreseeable by him. The evidence established that Brumfield was kicked out of Carol Armstrong's crime family sometime in July of the year 2000, and paragraph 18 of the pre-sentence investigation indicated that that happened in mid-July 2000. That's consistent with the testimony that was given by both Carol Armstrong and Patricia Waldrop during the sentencing hearing. There's no evidence that Brumfield started drug dealing again until about mid-November of 2000, when he was first...
The district court was clearly aware of that fact, right?
The district court should have been aware of that fact, yes.
Was the district court aware of that fact?
The fact that he didn't start again until mid-November?
That there was a hiatus in his participation in the conspiracy.
I'm not sure that the district court specifically referred to the hiatus in the findings that she made. I know that it was certainly stated in the pre-sentence report, and she kind of adopted the analysis of the pre-sentence report.
Well, kind of, she said she did, right?
Yeah, she did adopt the analysis of the pre-sentence report. So in that sense, yeah, I would say she was aware of the hiatus.
So the only question then is whether she took that into consideration in adjudicating the sentence, am I right?
Correct. And
what's your best shot saying that she didn't take that into consideration?
The fact that the pre-sentence report itself erred in its analysis, because the pre-sentence attributed, it erred in 2 ways. First of all, it held Mr. Brumfield responsible for sales that Patricia Waldrop was making, even though the testimony that Patricia Waldrop herself gave didn't support any finding that she was selling drugs before mid-July of 2000, when he left the crime family. And secondly,
the district court attributes those sales to your client, Waldrop sales?
42 grams of them, yes. The district court also adopted the pre-sentence approach, which held Brumfield responsible for 2 months of dealing after he left the Armstrong family in mid-July, but after he returned to drug dealing. The pre-sentence basically said that he was in and out of the Armstrong family, and so it wouldn't be fair to hold him responsible for everything from August through December. The problem is there's no evidence that he was involved at all in drug dealing again before mid-November. He was arrested in mid-December. So we've got only a window of about a month in which there's any evidence at all that he was involved in drug dealing. The court nonetheless held him responsible for 2 months of sales that were made by Armstrong, Pena, and Lefebvre. And that simply isn't supported by the evidence. There's also no evidence that he was, when he came back, aware of the scope of Carol Armstrong's activities. He was selling a few grams when he came back. There's no evidence that he was aware that Armstrong had over a kilogram of cocaine. The other problem is the court's decision to hold Brumfield responsible for selling 1.3 kilograms himself. The court based that finding on the testimony of Waldrop that she saw Brumfield selling half a gram or half an ounce per day from April through mid-July. The problem is that Waldrop testified that she couldn't say for sure that she even knew Brumfield in April. She didn't know if she met him on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd. In fact, she said, I might not have met him until May. And yet, he was held responsible for a half an ounce per day through the month of the entire month of April, which is 15 ounces. For all of those reasons, we would respectfully submit that the evidence simply didn't support the district court's findings as to relevant conduct, and his sentence should be vacated.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Ms. Rolfson?
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Krista Roth, and I represent Luis Pena in this appeal. I'd like to start out by indicating and saying that the scope of the appeal for Mr. Pena is quite narrow, and it focuses on the issue of whether or not the district court committed clear error in not considering Mr. Pena's request of a 2-4 level reduction under Section 3B1.2. It is our contention that the court did not address that issue at all, and that is clear error, and that we would ask that this case be remanded for purposes only of consideration of whether or not there should be some level reduction given under 3B1.2 for Mr. Pena's minimal or minor participation. The main grounds for this are that Mr. Pena was held accountable for 304. He was convicted of one count of conspiracy in this case, and he was held accountable for 302 grams. Judge Crabb, in her ruling and in her sentencing, found that I believe at page 38 of the sentencing transcript, that she held him accountable for all acts and omissions that were part of the same course of conduct or common scheme or plan as to the offense of conviction, which, as I state, was a conspiracy count. The government in the pre-sentence report simply indicated with regard to the argument or the motion for the level reduction, indicated that since she held him accountable for only 302 grams rather than the full scope of the Armstrong conspiracy, that this was enough to address the issue. I don't believe that that's what the case law is, and the fact that the judge never addressed it at all and said in her sentencing that she was holding him accountable for all of his conduct that is attributable to him in the conspiracy does not address the issue of what the scope of his conduct with regard to his participation in the conspiracy as a whole and his participation as to these 302 grams specifically were concerned.
302 grams.
That was in the pre-sentence report, and in fact there was I had made an objection to that. The initial pre-sentence report held him attributed to him more than that, and there was a calculation error made in that and in the addendum.
So that was taken care of, wasn't it?
That was taken care of. Although there was still some minor disputes as to how we got to the figure, but I did concede at the sentencing that we weren't going to dispute.
Now, the PSR purported to attribute to your client simply the amount with which your client actually dealt, am I right?
The PSR did say that was specifically what they allege mm-hmm. his It was an averaging, actually. There's no specific evidence of anything. But the judge held that she was holding him accountable if this was his total participation. And this goes in some ways directly to the issue of his minimal involvement in the overall conspiracy, but also with regard to the amount that he was held accountable for. And that is that this man, an elderly gentleman who had very little education, illiterate, and some other serious problems, didn't live with his family, even though Ms. Carol Armstrong was his ex-wife or common law wife, didn't live there, had very little contact with the family, and during the course of this whole big conspiracy, there were a few times during those 2 years or year and a half that she requested that he that he helped her by delivering, basically selling out of her home some preset amounts where she had gotten the person who was buying it, she had packaged it, she had determined the amount. She simply asked him to basically hand it over to this person because she wasn't going to be there and she wasn't going to be available. He gained nothing financially from this. She had a lot of influence over him because she was his payee, for one thing. She controlled his finances, but she never gave him any money. And I see that I'm out of time here. Does that mean I don't... Can I use up my rebuttal time on this?
We'll provide for a little rebuttal.
Okay,
thank you, Ms. Ralston. Ms. Waller?
Good afternoon. I'm John Beaudry. I'm an assistant up in Madison. I'm representing the United States in this appeal. First, addressing the Brumfield argument, addressing Judge Ripple's questions, Judge Crabb did and was specifically aware of the hiatus and took that into account in her calculations. I don't usually bring things to the podium, but in her judgment, the statement of reasons in the judgment, she said between April 2000 and mid-July, and again in November and December, he jointly undertook activity, so on and so forth. And then she notes parenthetically, he was in jail from mid-July to November, but was allowed by Armstrong to rejoin the conspiracy after his release from jail, as demonstrated by his statements to an undercover officer, in November concerning the storage of cocaine and the new telephone numbers the group was using. In fact, when dealing with an undercover officer in November, Mr. Brumfield said things like, they aren't storing it at the house anymore. They gave me a new phone. That's my recollection.
But there were 42 grams which Waldrop sold that apparently were attributed to him?
Yeah, there were the amounts.
I don't quite follow that.
The way this is calculated was approximately 1.3 kilograms specifically came from the Waldrop testimony that while she was with Mr. Brumfield, not while he was in jail, but while she was with him before he went to jail, he was selling between a half an ounce and an ounce every day. And after cross-examination, she said, okay, maybe there was one day I wasn't with him. The judge and the PSR took the half ounce and not some calculation between a half and 1 ounce. Judge Crabb also attributed somewhere between 35 and 70 grams that was sold directly by Mr. Brumfield to a confidential informant. And then, and this is where the Waldrop amount comes in, there was another 134 grams that was sold by Waldrop, perhaps Mr. Pena, I can't remember, but the various other co-conspirators, to the confidential informant and undercover officers while Mr. Brumfield was out with them. Let's put it that way. So the 42 grams from Ms. Waldrop would have been something she sold to a police person, either a cop or a cooperating person, while Mr. Brumfield was part of the group and not while he was in jail. So that, and then the final kilo simply comes from the amount that was seized from Carol Armstrong at the time of her arrest on December 3. And not surprisingly, I think, and I'll wrap up on Mr. Brumfield, Mr. Kelly attempts to move this case from quite simply a credibility call to sort of constitutional overtones that we more often see when the judge only considers hearsay testimony. Was it hearsay evidence? Excuse me. Was it reliable? And those sort of concepts. This really, at least in my view, the government's view, is a very simple case of just a credibility call in large part, and not based on hearsay. Judge Crabb saw Carol Armstrong. She was called at sentencing by Mr. Brumfield as a witness, and she thought she just lied right through the top of her hat for the whole time, and she said so. Ms. Waldrop took the stand. She was cross-examined, and she gave her testimony. And after that, Judge Crabb, both at the sentencing hearing and in her written judgment, said she was relying on that testimony. She did not go through and parse every inconsistency or every argument, but it is clear by adopting the pre-sentence report and by her statements at the sentencing hearing when she attributed, 1.3 kilograms of conduct to Mr. Brumfield based really exclusively on Ms. Waldrop's testimony about their relationship at that time. She was accepting that, and that's her call. It was not clear error, and certainly nothing in the sort of inconsistencies and whatnot in Ms. Waldrop's testimony or out of the ordinary sort of thing that judges deal with on a daily basis. As to Mr. Pena, I think it's important to see how this reduction, reduction for only offense really came up, because it seems a little convoluted to me at least. The request for reduction, I think both in the motion filed by Ms. Ralston on the day of sentencing and in the brief, and also in the sentencing transcript itself, an argument, was really all a part of a request for a downward departure. Right from the get-go at sentencing, Judge Crabb, as she does usually, you know, have your problems been solved by the addendum, and it boils down to all that's left is the motion for departure. And I think, at least I think a fair reading of the argument is that this two or four level reduction for a role in the offense is really, and was put to Judge Crabb as more of a touchstone for the amount of departure. Because the main thrust of the argument was his age and so on. I think, and even in the, I believe at pages 31 or 32.
Defendant was 61?
Pardon me?
Defendant was 61.
Yeah, elderly.
You endorse that position?
No. As I sit here with brand new bifocals trying to read my notes, I can assure you I do not endorse that assessment at all. My concern is
Social Security does those.
Yeah. And you can get that 10% discount at hotels as well. So. I think the reason that's so, that it came all apart with the downward departure, at sentencing, and Ms. Ralston noted, and she said, I recognize that the reduction shouldn't be given when his conduct alone is the basis for the guideline calculations, but went on to argue how it would, again, I think, be a touchstone for departure. The other reason I think that's the only reason, the only way Judge Crabb could really meaningfully see this request is that, quite frankly, at least as I see it, that adjustment under 3B1.2 is really meaningless in a career offender case. I mean, Mr. Pena, his sentence is driven entirely by the career offender status. He was, I believe, the pre-sentence had him at the level 24 for the base offense with his 302 grams. Whether you reduce 2, whether you reduce it 4 to 22 or 20, it doesn't make a whit of difference because his guideline is 32. And that is the career offender guideline. So I think given that this is all part of the motion for departure, Judge Crabb specifically, both in writing and at the sentencing hearing, denied the motion for reduction. Even if one were to consider the merits of the adjustment, as I think came out in your question, Judge Ripple, that 302 grams is only Mr. Pena's sales to the confidential informant, and only the sales he and Ms. LaFave, his specific co-defendant in the information that we filed, only their specific sales to Ms. Waldrop. So it doesn't take into account anything, as we just talked about with Mr. Brumfield, anybody else's sales. It doesn't take into account the seizures or anything like that. And I think if the cases in this court make it pretty clear, when it's just what you were doing, you have to be a key player. I mean, the stuff was sold and he sold it. So he couldn't be a minor participant in his own criminal conduct. But Judge Crabb specifically found no departure, and I think all of that really was part of the departure request. Any other questions? Otherwise,
If I may, with respect to Mr. Brumfield.
Yes.
There was a question as to whether he was blindsided by the failure to, by the court's reliance, really, on 1B1A2. I'd like to get your thought on that. I mean, it really wasn't mentioned to us, was it?
No, I think The argument is that he was not given notice of a guidelines factor. And my first point would be that I don't think this is a guidelines factor, first of all. A guideline factor, the factor in this case really would be relevant conduct. That is going to be a factor of sentencing, much like possession of a gun, a victim who was injured, the sorts of things that when all of a sudden at sentencing a judge increases your sentence because you had a gun and drug dealing, then you are blindsided. What happened here was it was clear from anybody from reading the PSR that relevant conduct, that factor, was going to drive the whole sentencing. In the PSR, well, starting with the plea letter, it was clear that we cite, as we always do, to 1B1.3 and say, look, you should be aware that all relevant conduct will be considered. I think 1B1.3, whether one is under A1 or A2, is simply guidance or guiding concepts related to that factor. It may be that in reading the PSR, one would think, well, relevant conduct is what we have to face. That's what we have to argue. And obviously he was prepared, Mr. Kelly, as he always is. He called witnesses, he argued relevant conduct, and if there is any sort of confusion going in, it would be what specific guiding concept is the court going to use underneath, or within, I guess, 1B1.3, is it going to be A1 or A2? And there was, I will agree, some mixed language there where perhaps A1 is being cited, and as the concepts are being discussed, they do seem to be more the words out of A2. But I think the important notice is that factor, that being the relevant conduct, was going to be considered, and the language in the PSR, none of that changed in terms of the facts or how the facts were added up. The only thing that was perhaps somewhat unclear was which specific, section of the guideline of 1B1.3 is being used.
If I may, was there any objection made?
I apologize. I don't remember. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Orr. Mr. Kelly, as we're opening time, we expire, but you may each have a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Your Honor, in response to your last question, I did, in fact, object at the sentencing hearing to the fact that the district court was relying upon A2 when the pre-sentence report gave us notice only that a sentence would be based on A1.
And what did the district court, how did the district court respond to that?
I made that in the course of my argument and during the course of the district court's announcement of the sentence, she didn't respond to that argument.
How were you prejudiced by this, given what went on at that sentencing hearing?
Well, I think...
You knew what the score was, right?
I knew what the score was, and to be candid, I did anticipate that the government might be arguing under A2, but I think that the law requires that we be given notice in advance of what the factors or what the sentence is going to be based on, and we didn't get that. The only other point that I want to respond to is Mr. Vaudry's argument, which is basically the argument that they make in their brief, which is that we're making an analysis here that's dependent upon an attack on credibility, and we're not doing that. I'm not arguing that Armstrong was more credible than Waldrop. I'm arguing that if you believe everything the government witnesses say, they still don't get around the fact that Mr. Brumfield is being sentenced for conduct during times when he's simply not a part of this conspiracy, or there's no evidence that he's a part of the conspiracy.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Ms. Rolfe?
I guess I probably need to talk fast. First of all, with regard to the government's assertion that the request for the level reduction for minimal participation was just a touchstone for the request for downward departure, that's not really true. Admittedly, it wasn't the main part of the motion. The main part was for the downward departure. We have not appealed that because the judge did, even though I don't agree with her decision, but she used her discretion and she made her decision on it and gave some reasons. The downward departure was an alternative, the minimal minor participation was in addition to that, or it's an alternative to that, that she at least considered that part. It was not a major part of the sentencing argument, but it was there enough for her to understand that that's what I was arguing. It was there enough for the probation agent who did the addendum to the PSR to understand that. And so I don't think that that's confusing at all. It's also not, it's not meaningless in terms of a career offender, because obviously you can go down from level 32. He got a three-level reduction for taking responsibility, and our contention is that he's entitled to additional 2 to 4-level reduction for his minimal participation in both the overall conspiracy, but specifically in terms of his participation in the acts for which he was held accountable was minimal. These were not his sales. He was, as I said before, simply handing something over, doing a favor for a woman who pretty much had control over him. Thank
you. Case is taken under advisement. Our thanks to all counsel. Ms. Kelly, I want to thank you on behalf of the court for accepting this appointment. And Ms. Ralston, the same obvious thanks go to you and to the law school program for us. All right. Well, we thank him also. Court will stand in recess.